This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review program. We have a great program for you today. Lots of important news to discuss. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff from the Philadelphia Trumpet Magazine, Robert Morley.
Hello.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And via Skype from our office in the UK, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Brent Noctegal is an instructor at our summer camp and is not here with us today. So we're just going to have to pull extra weight, gentlemen. Our lead story today, the world economy, what is going to happen when the next crisis hits? The Bank of International Settlements says that it's going to be dangerous. It's going to be nasty. Robert has written a cover story for this week's edition of the Trumpet Weekly. Robert, can you tell us about this story?
Right. So late last month, the Bank of International Settlements, this is one of the world's leading financial authorities. It's been called the central bank for the world's central banks, came out with a very damning report warning that there are no more lifeboats. When the next economic crisis strikes, they say that central banks have done basically everything they can and there's no more policy tools left. The Telegraph, commenting on this report, called it a scathing critique of global monetary policy. And according to the BIS, they're warning that monetary policy is already testing its outer limits to the point of stretching the boundaries of the unthinkable. And this report goes through and it talks about how central banks have relied on the very things to solve the problem that actually caused the problem in the first place. They said they relied on the very debt-fueled growth model that lay at the root of the crisis. And these reports, the report's authors are arguing that central banks like the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, they're out of options to deal with this crisis. But actually, even worse than that, if you read between the lines of the report, they're actually implying that these central banks are in large part a cause of the crisis, and they're going to be the cause of the next crisis that is coming. This is what the Bank for International Settlements is warning. And they say that what's going on is that these central banks have incessantly cut interest rates to deal with economic problems. When the bubbles burst in 2008, for example, when Wall Street went into meltdown, we were hours away from total financial destruction. They slashed interest rates. They began printing money like crazy. And when they slash these interest rates, a desire to increase debt, to flood the system with more debt. And over time, this has caused debt levels to rise again. And looking at the world, we're back to where we were before. We've actually gone beyond where we were before. So every time there's been a bubble, you can trace this back to the dot-com bust before that. You can go to long-term capital management. Every time there's been a crisis, central banks have cut interest rates. But here we are today at the point where interest rates are at zero. They're zero bound, or in some countries around the world, they're in negative territory. And the BIS is warning central banks have no more room. They can't cut interest rates anymore. They're stretching the limits. There's no more lifeboats left. There's nothing they'll be able to do when the next crisis strikes. Just a couple of days before the BIS, I thought this was really interesting, before the BIS issued their report, Jim Rogers, he's a very well-known investor, very well-respected in financial circles. He gave an interview. And in this interview, I want to read you a quote because I think it's just so important. He said, quote, "I expect that within the next year or two, we will see some major, major problems in the world financial markets. I suspect," he said, "it will cause central banks to panic. By 2016, I'm sure we will all be moaning and groaning because there is going to come a time when there is not much central banks can do, when they have lost all credibility, when governments have lost all credibility. They will print and spend and borrow, but there comes a time when people are just going to say, we don't want to play this game anymore. And at that point, that is when the world has a serious, serious problem because there is nothing to rescue us." So here's Rogers, a very highly respected investor, and he's warning that there's nothing left. He's right in line with what the BIS is saying. This is something that I think we need to pay attention to when you have people of this caliber, the BIS caliber, issuing these warnings. The world's central bank of central banks issuing this warning. It's time to pay attention. And if you look around this world, you can see what they're worried about. I mean, debt levels are higher than they've ever been. The Federal Reserve's balance sheet has more than quintupled. Countries talk about austerity, but they all have higher debts. Yeah, and we can look at Puerto Rico in America. This isn't just in Europe. This is in America. We have cities that have gone bankrupt. You know, the Congressional Budget Office released a frightening report just a couple of weeks ago saying that we're facing a debt spiral if we don't get things under control in America. And they warned that within a decade, we could basically the economy could drown. So this is where we are in this world. Anyway, here's the point of all this. This is what I want our readers to take home from this. This is something, this financial collapse that the BIS is warning about, that Rogers is warning about, is something that we've been warning about for many, many years, warning that the Western world's financial system that's centered in America and Britain is going to collapse. And that's prophesied in your Bible. And our leaders, unfortunately, are unwilling and unable to do anything about it. It's coming. And in fact, our leaders have caused much of this problem. So if you want to know where this is all leading, go to thetrumpet.com. There's a video there by Gerald Fleury. It's titled Daniel and the Hidden Gospel. And it will explain all of this to you in more detail. It'll talk about some of these very same issues that you're hearing about today. So go to the website. At the top of the website, there's a Kia David tab. Click on that and it'll be right there on the front page for you.
I'm just reminded of what happened in 2008 when the politicians who were aware of what was going on, they said, it's been learned since just how serious that moment was in America's economy and really the global economy. And they said that they were staring into the abyss at that point. And like you said, they pulled out every trick in the book. They pulled every stunt that they could in order to prevent a meltdown from happening within a matter of hours. We did not realize. I mean, really, there were very few people who saw the extent of the damage that was about to take place at that time. But we have since learned, and in a way, it's almost like our complacency has grown since then because, another crisis averted and that type of thing. But as you say, the next time is going to be a whole lot different.
Yeah, it's at the time, I think our leaders didn't want to tell people about how close we came because there was still that danger that we would, like you said, head over into the abyss. But since then, we learned, Nancy Pelosi has come out and talked about how at that time she called Hank Paulson and said, hey, we have this trouble. I haven't had a briefing in a while. Do you think you could come in tomorrow and brief Congress? And he said, madam, there isn't going to be an economy if I come in tomorrow. I need to speak before you now. That's how close it is. And there's been other revelations since then as well. Very close. But like you said, when it doesn't happen, when we're saved, then it's back to business as usual. And that's where we're at again today.
But to think this is really something that we've been talking about for a long time, expecting it to happen. And it's like a lot of events that you see happening in the world, there's this inevitability to a day of reckoning. And you see this with the situation in Greece right now, where you think tomorrow's the day, it's going to happen, and then it just gets kicked down the road a little bit. But that does not, that doesn't negate the inevitability of what's going to happen. It's just a short delay, but it's right in front of us.
The can's been kicked. The question is, how much of the can is left? Can they do it again? That's what Rogers is saying. It's getting closer.
Well, we're on the subject of the economy, so I'd like to just stick with you, Robert, for a bit. Before we get into our next major story, let's just talk now about the overview of news from Anglo America. Can you give us the overview?
Sure. There's some very interesting things going on. On July 4th, the United States Air Force intercepted Russian bombers off the coast of California and Alaska. These bombers, they're Russian, they're 295 bombers. These are their bombers designed to deliver nuclear weapons. They were intercepted just, I think, 14 miles off the California coast. Another two were intercepted just a few miles off the coast of Alaska. Now, there's no word on whether they were armed or not, but Admiral Bill Gortney, he's the head of NORAD, North American Air Defense. He told reporters that Russia was sending a message to America, reminding us that it's a nuclear power that needs to be reckoned with, and we have to be careful with our dealings with them. So nice little happy Independence Day there, message from Russian President Vladimir Putin. In other news, Bill Gross said on Monday that we're in the eye of the hurricane with Greece. Bill Gross, if you remember, he's the founder and until recently the head of PIMCO, which is the largest bond investors in the world. These are the guys lending money to governments. He had over $3 trillion under management, one of the biggest money managers in the world, if not the biggest. And he's out there warning now, saying that Europe might appear economically calm, but it's only because, like we mentioned in that earlier story, central banks are throwing everything they have at keeping things from blowing apart right now. And that's with just little Greece in Europe. So that's how precarious things are. He's out there with that same message.
So another big economic story this week.
Right. Also related to what we are talking about, the Chinese financial markets this last week, especially were in turmoil. Over the past 3 weeks, the main Chinese stock market lost 30% of its value. Some of its other smaller markets lost even more. On one day alone, it lost more than 7%. These are massive, massive wealth-destroying moves. Just to put things in context for people, analysts say that the stock market crash that China has experienced over the last 3 weeks has wiped out $3 trillion worth of value. Just poof, gone, vanished. That's almost 17 times the annual GDP of Greece. That's over 10 times the amount that Greece owes to creditors. Canada, we're familiar with Canada. It's twice the size of Canada. Gone. So looking at what's going on in China, we see the government in China increasingly looking like it's panicked, that it's very worried about what's going on. The China's propaganda ministry ordered the state media to only publish positive opinions about the stock market. No more pieces criticizing the stock market. The 25 biggest mutual funds in China got together and announced that they were going to inject billions to stabilize things. The government banned all big stockholders from selling any of their stock. They're saying, you're not allowed to sell stock anymore. The government said that it was going to begin arresting people who were short selling stocks. And then the government got the biggest banks together, the biggest brokerage houses, and said, we need to increase the debt in the system. So start taking extra things as collateral. Let people put their houses up for collateral. Let people put their cars up for collateral and lend them the money so they can buy these stocks and keep things propped up for value. So we're seeing major developments taking place in China. Then China, the Chinese government dropped what was probably the biggest bombshell. It said that it was going to begin buying stocks in the market using its foreign exchange reserves. These are its holdings of U.S. dollars, U.S. treasuries. It was going to start spending that money to prop up its bank. So here we have an impact for America. China's our biggest lender. We rely on China to finance our deficit spending over here. And if they can't lend us money, then the question is, where is that money going to come from? How are we going to keep spending? And if they're selling our holdings, then that has a whole other host of implications off of that. Interest rates. Interest rate could be pressures to rise in America. Our economy, heavily reliant on debt as well. Rising interest rates are a death blow to our economy, which is already struggling at this point. So we're seeing how panicked China is and some developments economically over there that are very, very astounding and need to be watched closely.
Well, it's interesting because so much of the news out of China lately has just been its ascendance, its rise, it's extending its power within the region, its hegemony is increasing. We've been hearing a lot about its cyber espionage activities against the United States, and it's been all bull market for China in so many ways, but this is really kind of running counter to that. Do you have any thoughts about that, Jeremiah?
Yes, I think that one trend that we've been closely watching is this convergence of Russia and China. The two of them have been cooperating at an unprecedented level. And at the trumpet, we've said that Russia will be the leader of that alliance. It'll be Russia and not China who's leading it. But that view has been contrary to what a lot of analysts have said. Almost everyone has said, you know, that they see the cooperation, but they say China is leading it. China's economy dwarfs Russia's. China's power in many ways dwarfs Russia's. So this development this week, or over the past 3 weeks, with China's stock market just crumbling, that really could be a way that we see the Russia alliance come together in a way that positions Russia and not China on top of it if China is weakening in this way.
Yeah, not to take anything away from what you said. I think it's what you said is very valid, and I think you're right about that. Just to put this collapse in context a bit, markets, as you said, in China's done very well. They've risen a lot over the last decade. So as much as it has fallen recently, I mean, if you project back, China has done amazing advances. So there's still a lot of wealth and power in China.
Well, what would be some of the possible effects of this? For one thing, it really does give you yet another indicator, yet another example of just how unstable the global economy is and how quickly something can change. And we've been talking about how skittish investors are and trying to find some kind of a safe haven for their money. And China has been, with some of its recent moves, trying to set itself up as maybe one of those safe havens. And yet this is a really big blow to that. What are some of the ramifications of this development in China?
Well, I think we're seeing trust in central banks being questioned and trust in governments being questioned in a way that we haven't seen probably since the 1930s maybe the 1970s when the U.S. dollar went off the gold standard. And we see China has made a lot of moves, as you said, to set itself up as an alternative to the dollar. It's not there yet, but it has been. It's the world's biggest importer of gold. I think we're going to see in the future as trust in fiat currencies, paper money is questioned. China starts to emphasize its growing gold reserves and the moves it's taken to become the world's largest producer of gold now and consumer of gold. And we're going to start to see the world looking at other places outside of America and Britain, especially for financial leadership.
I do wonder how does Europe respond to this? Again, like we've talked quite a lot about how important it is to watch Europe for how it responds to major events within Asia. We've been talking a lot of particularly about Russian aggression and military advancement. But it certainly has to be looking at China in a lot of ways, too, and responding to what's happening in China. Obviously, from a standpoint of responding to China's rise, but here is there's another a dimension to this story in the fact that here China is showing some bumps in the road. And again, someone needs to step up and to be that safe haven for investors. It will be interesting, I guess, really. Overall, you have to say we can expect that the world economy is going to look completely different in a very short amount of time than it does today.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say this has got to be a huge impetus for Europe to get its act together, to congeal around a solid core group of nations that are committed to using one financial system, one currency. And I think when you have that centered around Germany, and I think this crisis is happening in Greece is part of that. And what's happening in China might add to that, too. And when we see the trouble, increasing troubles out of America and Britain, which are just right now under the surface, Europe is going to come together very quickly when they're faced with crisis.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program. We've been talking to trumpet writer Robert Morley about some big economic news. Now, since we're talking about China and potential ramifications within Asia and beyond, we're going to stay with this theme and look at the overview of headlines from Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, can you give us the headlines from Asia?
Sure. Yes. This week, two of Japan's major military units announced their first ever joint drills. This is big news. It's just another sure sign of Japan's march away from pacifism and toward becoming a full-fledged military power once again. And this particular drill is really significant because the Japanese forces here are practicing defending against what is called a gray zone incident. That means something that's short of an attack on Japan. In the past, Japan has been strictly limited to defending against clear attacks on its territory. But now they're planning for these gray zone incidents. And I think the definition of that is something that can be stretched in a way that can really allow for easy deployment of the Japanese military in ways that have been impossible for the last 65, 70 years. Mm-hmm. This week, we also saw the leaders of Russia and China meeting together at a summit that combined the BRICS nations with the SCO nations. And
SCO being...
That's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's Russia and China and then four Central Asian nations.
So BRICS added to that would be which nations?
BRICS is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. So basically the nations that are really trying to come together in a way that challenges this era of U.S. dominance. So they held a joint summit with the two groups this week. And Vladimir Putin spoke with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, and he said that with Russia and China cooperating so closely now, that the two can overcome any difficulties. So a pretty powerful statement there. And then this week we also saw another snap military drill by Russia. This time it was at a base in Armenia. And a lot of Europeans are just concerned about the increasing size, scale, and frequency of these snap drills by the Russian military. It's clear to many analysts that what Russia is doing is really using these drills to posture its military forces near foreign borders, especially in Eastern Europe.
All right, thanks for that. The big story this week.
The big story is that despite a lot of wishful thinking in the West, China is not withdrawing its support of North Korea. In the past year or so, we've seen all kinds of Western analysts just sort of joyously proclaiming that China has finally had enough of Pyongyang and the Kim dynasty that's ruling North Korea. They've said that Beijing is finally tired of defending this basket case regime in North Korea. There was a headline in the New York Times that said, "Chinese annoyance with North Korea bubbles to the surface." That was at the end of last year. Around the same time, War is Boring wrote, "China kinda hates North Korea." And at the same time, there was a big analysis piece in the Daily Tech that said, "China is losing patience as North Korea threatens another nuclear strike on the United States." So there were all kinds of reports like this coming out, and Western onlookers were ecstatic. They were excited. China is really the only global force that has kept this Kim dynasty alive. So these writers and analysts were just celebrating. They said, you know, if China's withdrawing its support, then that would mean the collapse of this poisonous, diabolical regime. It would mean the world, you know, would be safe from at least one lunatic's nuclear arsenal. It would mean the economic opening up of this rogue nation. It would mean the end of the suffering and the starvation of North Korea's 25 million people. But in this Trumpet.com article that we've got up this week, we prove that the facts on the ground show that all of these joyous proclamations were hasty. They were just wishful thinking. And we just show that the evidence really proves that Beijing will not be coming around to the West viewpoint anytime soon, and that they will not be withdrawing their support of the Kim dynasty. If you look a little bit below the surface, you see that Beijing is still fueling North Korea's military. It's secretly pumping all kinds of oil into the country, very large quantities of oil, which fuel that military machine. China is also giving massive amounts of food aid to the North, and this goes in direct violation of international principles, which say food aid has to go to the citizens who need it. Instead, China is giving it to the North in such a way that the military and the ruling regime are really the ones eating, and the citizens go on starving. The Chinese continue to shield North Korea from international efforts to investigate all of its human rights violations. They have veto power there in the United Nations, and they use that all the time to protect this Kim dynasty.
So what's in it for China?
That is the big question. It's not hard to see what's in it for the North. I mean, they would collapse immediately without Chinese help. But why would China, you know, the world's most powerful economy, at least on the basis of purchasing power, what do they benefit from propping up this lunatic regime? And the answer is basically that North Korea, its ideologies and its ambitions are in perfect alignment with China's top global priority, and that is to undermine the power of the United States. So China is really supporting the North because it can use it as a tool to challenge America. I mean, there are plenty of other reasons. China likes North Korea as a buffer zone between the Chinese territory and South Korea, where there are some 28,000 U.S. troops stationed. It also likes to use North Korea as a distraction. you know, when America is focused on North Korea's human rights abuses and its illegal military buildup, that leaves a lot less scrutiny and focus for Chinese human rights abuses and illegal military activities. But on the whole, though, it's just that their ideologies align. They share this desire to bring an end to the era of U.S. dominance in the world.
Thanks for explaining that to us, Jeremiah. The title of this article, No, Beijing Isn't Withdrawing Support for North Korea. It's on thetrumpet.com. It's also in the Trumpet Weekly this week, this informative, high-quality news report that we produce each week that has all of the stories that we've been talking about here included in this issue. We do our very best to accumulate the top news from the week, the most significant stories from the week. You can subscribe to this free weekly news report. You can receive it in your email inbox every week. Just go online to thetrumpet.com to become a subscriber. The Trumpet Weekly. Coming up next, we have news from Europe and the Middle East, and later on in the show, our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We will be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week. We're going to turn our attention now to Europe. Richard Palmer in the UK, can you give us the overview of what happened in Europe this week?
Well, not strictly Europe, but I'll cover it anyway. The Pope has been making a big trip to Latin America this week, and he's been making plenty of headlines everywhere he goes. He drew huge crowds in Ecuador, lots of people on the streets, etc. And he repeated some of the calls that he made earlier in his encyclical for a kind of new world order, new global system, new way of doing things. Though at the same time, he also gave the Bolivian president a telling off for giving him a hammer and sickle made in the shape of a cross. Then it was also announced this week that when he visits the White House, that visit and that speech will be displayed on big screens outside. So it really looks like the Vatican is starting to turn his America trip into a big media event. So it'll be interesting to watch out for that in September. Then the other thing I'll mention quickly is there's the NSA scandal with America spying on Germans is still ticking over, and more of that was revealed this week, and they spied on more people than had previously been revealed. That included German officials, and it also included journalists from Der Spiegel magazine. And as you can imagine, Spiegel is not best pleased about that. And so they had an article this week declaring that the Germano-American friendship was over.
What was the big story this week? I'm going to take a guess, Richard, that it's about Greece.
Yes, it's been our big story for I don't know how many weeks now. This week has been quite the roller coaster week. Last week on this program, we were talking about Greece as our big story. And I said that I thought that they would vote yes in the referendum on Sunday, and that they would accept the creditors' demands. And instead, I was very wrong on that. They voted no overwhelmingly in large numbers, 61%, I believe, the no vote.
It takes received. A big man to admit he's wrong, Richard, but I'm impressed.
Thank you. But I was going to go on to say that a lot of other people were wrong, too. Apparently, even the Greek government. And so the start of this week was in this weird kind of limbo where the Greek government apparently didn't have much of a proposal to put forward in the case that they got a no vote. And the rest of the other European leaders weren't really expecting a no vote either. So it took them about 3 days before they figured out what they were actually going to do. So now they've caught up and it looks like it could be quite interesting. It looks like they've come to some kind of compromise. We're still seeing the details of that today. Greece has agreed to pretty much all of the creditors' demands. They're going to let the creditors dictate and Europe dictate their VAT rate, their taxes. That's VAT is a sales tax.
So so I understand, the fact that they're acquiescing to these demands is contrary to the results of the referendum, isn't it?
That's right. However, the key thing to watch now is debt relief, and that's the term that will be used mostly in the media, debt relief. What it really is it's all about whether Europe is going to forgive Greece some of their debt, whether they're going to tell them they don't have to pay it back. And that's the big unknown. If Greece does get a good chunk of their debt written off, then really that will be quite a victory for them, I think. And they'll come out of this looking pretty good. However, at the moment, it doesn't look that way. debt relief is not written into the important deals and proposals that have been submitted to the European creditors. Instead, it has been relegated to a piece of paper that is called a non-paper in EU's very opaque bureaucratic language. And so really we'll have to wait over the next few days and see what that commitment is. There is some precedent here. In 2012, Germany and the other European creditors essentially promised Greece debt relief, and they went back on their word then. So if it just remains some kind of vague commitment that's not really spelled out, that doesn't happen anytime soon, then really I don't think Greece is getting anything at all. And that's why actually Yanis Varoufakis, the previous Greek finance minister, said that he would not accept any deal without having firm and written promises for debt relief. That's basically what we're looking at now. Now, of course, there's still the chance that this could all fall through. That kind of thing has happened before. Everyone could still come to a European meeting. And remember, it's not a case of just Angela Merkel saying no. Even Slovakia, they could say no and be really obstinate and derail the deal. Or Finland. So there's plenty of ways that this could still be derailed. And also remember that Greek banks have been shut not just this or last week, and then they didn't reopen after the referendum. They've been shut all this week as well. The banks are in huge trouble. Morgan Stanley just came out an hour or two ago, said that they thought some Greek banks would run out of money by Sunday. So even if they do agree a deal, there is still a chance of a banking crisis that could push Greece out of the euro.
Just to recap, obviously we've been talking about this a lot over the previous weeks. What is at stake? What are the big issues? You know, we continue to remain in this wait and see posture, but when it's all said and done, what could be the outcome of this disaster?
Yes, glad you asked that. Well, the first point I'll make is I think the best case outcome from this weekend is more wait and see. And even if they come to a deal, in whoever's favor, it is not going to solve the fundamental causes of the crisis. It's going to kick the can down the road some more. So if Greece gets debt relief in a big way, then you're going to start to see Italy and Spain want debt relief, and we'll see the whole crisis played out there. If they don't get debt relief, the IMF says that Greece needs about 30% of its debt written off to be sustainable. If they don't get that, then we're going to see Greek crisis again in another year or two, or potentially sooner. So best case outcome from this weekend is we're still going to face this crisis again in the future. Ultimately, this is about Europe's place in the world and about Europe's role in the global economy. Now, the analysis that we've always come back to at the Trumpet is that the euro was created to cause a crisis. It isn't sustainable. You can't have all of these countries in the euro without sharing a common government, and we've spelled that out. Why that's the case fairly clearly in some of our articles you can go and look at on the website. So this was designed all along to form a crisis because those in charge of Europe want Europe to become a kind of federalized state, a super state. But the people of Europe don't want that. Greeks don't feel more European than they do Greek. They feel Greek. European, even if they even identify with being a European, that's very much a second tier identification. And so the euro was created to force all of these different nations to unite. And that is what is at stake here.
It was designed to force them to unite in response to a crisis, in other words. You would reach a point where you had no choice but to come together politically in order to solve the crisis.
Exactly. And Bernard Connolly, he was a former European bureaucrat who wrote the book The Rotten Heart of Europe. In that book, he talks about how the European Union, the European Central Bank's mandate was to cause exactly this crisis. And we're seeing it. But at the moment, each crisis has not been yet bad enough to force that union, because that is quite a big thing to overcome. I mean, imagine Americans and Canadians deciding to become one country. There would be huge resistance to that, even though both sides get on pretty well and have a similar outlook.
As a Canadian, I can say that would never happen.
But you've got the same kind of pressures in Europe, and they're not going to come together in the same kind of unity that you see in, say, United States of America, but they're trying to create something pretty close. And of course, there's a huge resistance to that, and so it's going to take quite a really big crisis to cause that to happen. And if that doesn't happen, the euro falls apart, the probably even the European Union, the whole European project falls apart, and you'd see the entire continent becoming much poorer and much less influential. And there are a lot of people that think that is what is going to happen. But of course, you know, we at the Trumpet, we know that, and we've been saying that's not going to happen. We can tell that from history, and we can see that from Bible prophecy.
Well, it's very important for us to keep our eyes on the big picture in the middle of this crisis in Greece. Thank you very much for that report, Richard.
Thank you.
We're going to look finally at the Middle East with our Middle East expert off this week. This job falls to me. So first, we'll start with an overview of the region. Tension is ramping up in Egypt between the Sisi government and the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood has been ramping up its calls for an overthrow of Sisi and his military-backed government, and they have a lot of support for this across the Muslim world. On June 29th, Egypt's prosecutor general was assassinated. This is a man who was known for prosecuting Muslim Brotherhood supporters. On July 1st, 9 senior Muslim Brotherhood leaders were killed. So now the Muslim Brotherhood says this means war. This is going to have serious repercussions. Anthony Chibatawe wrote an article this week on thetrumpet.com, and it's in the Trumpet Weekly this week. Is the Muslim Brotherhood plotting to retake Egypt? So we're watching for Egypt to become more radicalized. So definitely a situation that bears close watching. The Vatican recently struck that deal with the Palestinians, recognizing the Palestinian state. Israeli diplomats have been asking for a copy of this. They want to see this deal. Well, this week, Haaretz reported that the Vatican is saying, no, you can't see it. This agreement is a secret. The Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs says that the Vatican is making unilateral decisions about the future of Israel while it's ignoring the rights of the Jews. And they're afraid that this secret agreement that they're not even allowed to see, that this is contradicting a treaty that it already made with the Vatican. So really, all of this backs up an article that the Trumpet's Brad McDonald wrote, an excellent article that's in the current edition of the Trumpet, Why is the Pope Provoking War in Israel? The fact that they're being so secretive really leads you to wonder what sort of promises they're making to the Palestinians. So the big story in the Middle East this week has been these ongoing Iranian nuclear negotiations. The deadline for this deal was last Tuesday. I have to say the deadline for this deal, but this is like, what, the 10th deadline for this deal. But they were not able to come to terms yet, so the negotiations continue. Last Sunday, an American diplomat who was involved in the negotiations said this: Obama wants this deal as the centerpiece of his legacy. This is somebody who's involved in this deal. He said he believes, President Obama believes, a peaceful Iran could be a bulwark against ISIS in the Middle East and the key to peace there. So think about that. And in one sense, you'd have to agree with this. A peaceful Iran could be the key to peace in the Middle East, right? That's true, isn't it? Why is that? It's because Iran is the main reason why there isn't peace in the Middle East. Obviously, the Islamic State is attracting the headlines right now, but talking about the main reason for problems in this region for the past 3.5 decades, it points to Iran. Iran is the main reason. But for some reason, President Obama believes Iran is peaceful and that it can be trusted as a key to peace there right now. Now, a U.S. official in Vienna says this week, you know, why allow these negotiations to keep on going on? Well, he says they're making plenty of progress. He made that statement to the New York Times on Wednesday. So, you know, they can justify ongoing talks with Iran because, well, we're making progress. What sort of progress could they possibly be making? The only progress that they've made so far, I'm putting that in big quotation marks, the word progress, is the United States caving in more and more. America has given in on insisting on being able to make inspections anywhere, anytime, no restrictions. Now, Iranians have to give approval for inspections. The U.S. says that they're negotiating a system of managed access to Iranian nuclear sites that would allow Iran to shield conventional secret military facilities from inspections. The United States says, well, this is only reasonable. You know, Iran has to protect its military secrets. America has given in on insisting that Iran come clean on its past nuclear activity. Now the United States says, well, look, we're focused on the future. We're not focused on the past. And they say that Iranians are, they'll come clean after the deal is signed, which is absolutely ridiculous. America has given in on immediate sanctions relief. Iran says we are not going to make a deal unless all sanctions are lifted immediately. The U.S., they've been saying, well, we're going to have gradual sanctions relief based on Iranian compliance. Now they're saying, well, okay, we'll lift all the sanctions, but we will reimpose sanctions. We'll have snapback sanctions if you're found to be in violation, which is absolutely never going to happen. They've caved in on all of these points. They've given in on saying that they would keep separate sanctions in place that were there because of Iranian support of terrorism. You know, regardless of the nuclear negotiations, well, we have these separate sanctions in place because of your activities in these other areas. Now the U.S. says all sanctions will be lifted. So they've caved in over and over and over on point after point after point. Now they say, well, we're really making progress. And what indication is there at all that the Iranians are giving in, you know, that any of this supposed progress is actually a result of the Iranians moving their position? This is what Jonathan Tobin wrote in Commentary Magazine. If this administration were truly willing to walk away from a bad deal, their tactics wouldn't be a matter of concern. But the relief about their flexibility about deadlines has been entirely premature. Whether they stay another 2 days, a week, or a month, Iran knows that the Americans will cave in sooner or later. Whether the deadlines are respected or the talks are allowed to drag out endlessly, the Iranians seem to benefit either way. Now, we had an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly from Bloomberg. The title is Obama's Nuclear Deal with Iran Hits a Snag Over Weapons Buildup. This is an interesting story. It says Russia is pressing to end a United Nations arms embargo on Iran at a time when the Islamic Republic is already poised to add potent offensive weapons to its arsenal with or without a deal. Analysts citing satellite imagery say the Iranian military is on the cusp of producing armor-busting bombs, a capability few nations can claim. This, in and of itself, is one more piece of evidence that shows Iran's bad faith, that they're making these advancements in spite of the deal. There's no indication that Iran is saying, well, you know, look, let's hold off for a while to at least give the pretense to the fact that we're trying to play nice with the West in this deal. But now you have Russia saying, well, we need to lift this arms embargo and allow more arms to flood into Iran. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said ending the UN's weapon ban was the only major sticking point on the sanctions relief Iran demands as the price of a nuclear pact. And it quotes this foreign minister talking to reporters in Vienna, "It is essential to reach an agreement on lifting the arms embargo as soon as possible." He said, "Giving Iran access to weapons to combat terrorism is a very important task." He wants to make sure that Iran has access to weapons in order to combat terrorism. But the weapons ban is in place because of Iran's sponsorship of terrorism. That's why we want to keep arms out of Iran. It's the top state sponsor of terrorism in the world. This man wants to basically arm the drug cartels in order to get their help in combating drug violence. That's the equivalent of what he's suggesting. Russia also plans, this is Bloomberg, to start supplying S-300 anti-aircraft defense systems to Iran this year over U.S. and Israeli objections, ending a self-imposed ban from 2010. So Russia is on Iran's side. And the concern here is what this Bloomberg article is saying is if the Russians were to get this UN arms ban lifted, do you know what the real problem here is? The real problem that this would create is it could jeopardize this deal because Congress is going to have the power to veto this deal. United States Congress could veto the deal. And basically, if Russia is allowed to lift this UN arms ban against Iran, well, that just gives Congress that much more ammunition to kibosh this deal. Here's a quote in this article from Gary Sick. This is a former National Security Council official under three U.S. presidents. He said, part of the reason the administration is going to care about this a great deal is that Congress will use it. Opponents of this deal will say Iran has a free hand to develop anything it wants. Yeah, opponents of this deal would say that because that's exactly the truth of the matter. And to think that the real problem with allowing Iran to be flooded with weapons is that it might jeopardize this deal just shows you how absolutely topsy-turvy our priorities are in this whole situation. There are so many aspects of this deal that stink to high heaven. I wrote an article a couple of weeks ago asking, are these the most insane negotiations in history? Last week, Charles Krauthammer's column was called the worst agreement in U.S. diplomatic history. This is a very prophetically significant story for a number of reasons. What this tells you about United States weakness, the fact that we're caving in time after time after time on issue after issue, to think of how big of a role this plays in helping the rise of Iran, which is a huge story that we talked a lot about for over 20 years at the Trumpet, and just how much that's reshaping the entire Middle East. There's even the aspect of how much this whole drama is drawing these anti-Iranian Arab states together in an alliance, which is another major building block in prophecy within the Middle East that we're watching for. How much this is putting an additional burden on Europe to deal with this problem, because it's helping Iran's rise. No one else is going to check Iran from becoming a strong power within that region. And Europe has to be looking at this and seeing something of high concern. There's just a lot of elements of this that I think are very fascinating to watch. And as this is playing out, it just highlights those prophecies more and more. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we're talking about here are in this weekly report, and it is yours for free. If you just request that, go to thetrumpet.com. We're going to finish the program after our break with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It is time now for our lightning round. This is our lightning round. We're going to make it really fast. A last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. We will start with Mr. Robert Morley.
Britain's defense secretary recently raised the question of whether Britain should retaliate against the Islamic State for beheading those 38 tourists in Tunisia. But now analysts are questioning that. They're wondering if Britain even has the capability to carry out such strikes. This is Britain we're talking about, former world superpower Britain, Britain that stood alone against the Nazis and all of Europe during World War II. And now analysts, military analysts say Britain doesn't even have the capability to strike a bunch of terrorists in Africa. This is because all three of Britain's services are at their lowest strength since the 1920s. The Telegraph quoted one defense expert as saying, quote, "We no longer have a credible army or a navy or an air force. But there's no need to worry about that because they're only of use if we have a credible defense policy based on a credible security policy, and we have neither." So we're seeing these analysts taking a look at the situation of Britain and saying, this is pathetic. But before we get ahead of ourselves and start criticizing Britain's military, we need to look at what's happening in America, because the Army has announced plans to cut a further 40,000 soldiers from its ranks and an additional 17,000 civilians that will be laid off. And this is going to bring the U.S. numbers down to 450,000 soldiers. For a little context, back in 2013, the Army, in a budget report, said that if the number of soldiers were to dip below 450,000, that it could potentially prevent us from prevailing in a war. So the warnings are growing. 450,000 is kind of this tipping point where we can't fight the wars that we want to be able to do that. And that's where we're at now.
All right. Thank you, Robert. We'll move now to Jeremiah.
Vladimir Putin's political party, the United Russia Party, just unveiled what's being called a straight flag. And this is a rival to the LGBT pride symbols, such as the rainbow-colored flags that are really growing in popularity in the Western world. Russia's new flag depicts two parents, a man and a woman, holding hands with three children. And at the unveiling ceremony, a spokesman said, "This is Russia's response to same-sex marriage, to this mockery of the concept of the family. We have to warn against gay fever at home and support traditional values in our country." This is a fascinating story. It's only the latest of many steps that Mr. Putin has taken to portray himself and Mother Russia as sort of the last defenders of traditional family in a world that's led by a morally bankrupt U.S. and Europe. I want to read a statement really quickly that Mr. Putin made in 2013. He said, "Many Euro-Atlantic countries have moved away from their roots, including Christian values. Policies are being pursued that place on the same level a multi-child family and a same-sex partnership. Policies are being pursued that equate a faith in God and a belief in Satan. This is the path to degradation." Those were Vladimir Putin's words back in 2013. So all of this is really deepening the cultural fault line between Russia and its European rivals. And this increases the probability of conflict between them.
It's really the opposite of the Cold War, isn't it?
It is. Back in the Cold War, almost everyone saw that as sort of the Christian Americans versus the godless communists of the USSR. And now that whole thing is reversed. It's the Americans who have abandoned Christian principles and the Russians who are defending them.
All right. Thank you, Jeremiah. We'll go now to Richard.
My story this week would be that a German-owned Patriot missile battery stationed in Turkey was briefly taken over by hackers. Exactly how they did it or what they did isn't yet clear. I think it's the first time that I can ever remember hackers actually taking over military hardware. In the news, sometimes we hear about, you know, like the Pentagon's website being hacked. And usually what that means is that's the digital equivalent of people going and spraying graffiti on the outside of the Pentagon itself. It's a bit embarrassing. They should really take better care of their property, but it's not that huge of a national security threat, apart from the incompetence that it implies. But this is something that's completely different. They actually took over a set of missiles, at least according to a German magazine. And that has some huge implications. They don't know exactly how they did it. These are American-made missiles. They might have done it using faulty computer chips, which, if that's the case, just about every weapon system America has includes forged computer chips. And Mr. Morley wrote an article on that. It was years ago, but it dramatically illustrated how reliant America is on that technology. Another way they might have done it is part of the way America's missile batteries talk to each other. And in that case, that opens the possibility. I mean, could they take over an Aegis cruiser then? And really, it puts America's entire defense infrastructure under suspicion and under threat. And as longtime listeners and readers of The Trumpet will know, this is something we've talked about. And Mr. Flory drew attention to a prophecy in Ezekiel that talks about how the trumpet sounds and nobody goes forth to battle. And he said that is because the military that they rely upon has been hacked and taken over by foreign forces.
Thank you, Richard. Article that caught my eye. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about how immigrants coming into the United States are such a benefit to this country and that they're coming here to work and that type of thing. Statistics from the U.S. Sentencing Commission that were obtained by Breitbart showed that illegal immigrants account for about 3.5% of the U.S. population, but they represent 36.7% of federal sentences in fiscal year 2014. So illegal immigrants represent 16.8% of drug trafficking cases, 74.1% of drug possession, 20% of kidnapping and hostage taking, 12% of murder convictions. And that of course, illustrated dramatically this past week with what happened in San Francisco. These are hard facts that should be at the center of the immigration debate, and they should be driving immigration reform. The fact that 3.5% of the population is committing 37% of federal sentences, that is dramatic, and it shouldn't be considered racist to say it. So I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All of the stories that we've talked about in today's program are in this report. Send us your thoughts, your questions by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook or Google Plus by searching for Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank our panel, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Herbert Spencer. The ultimate result of shielding men from the effects of folly is to fill the world with fools. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.